You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. My name is Mike McFaul, and I'm the director here at FSI. And I'm really thrilled today to have with me Marshall Burke. He's an expert on climate change, an assistant professor in the Department of Earth System Science. We're going to talk about what that is in a second. And he's also a fellow at the Center on Food Security and the Environment here at FSI. Climate change, as I hope most know, is already affecting human health. Rising sea levels have destroyed homes and crops in Southeast Asia. Droughts have left children malnourished in sub-Saharan Africa. And air pollution has caused millions of premature deaths around the world. Nobody I know has thought more about these issues, both analytically to understand them, but also prescriptively about how we might solve these problems, than Marshall. So it's really thrilling that we have you on World Class today, Marshall.
Great to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with, what does somebody do and what background do they have to work in the Department of Earth System Science and at the Center for Food Security and the Environment?
Yeah, that's right. So it's a sort of funny joint appointment. So my history with this actually starts as a Stanford undergraduate. So I started out convinced I wanted to be an environmental scientist, just work and focus my life's work on the environment. And I realized as I did that and took classes at Stanford, there was a human dimension that was a little bit missing in what I was studying. And I got much more interested in the human dimension, and my work bled more into the social sciences and in particular economics. So I left Stanford and went to an unmentionable university in the East Bay to get my PhD in economics.
Who we destroyed in the big game this year, of course,
yeah, as we always do. Got my PhD there, and then Stanford was nice enough to hire me back in this joint position, which I think, really enables me to explore both the social science side of environmental questions and the more natural science. So my departmental home is the Department of Earth System Science, which is mainly natural scientists, folks
right.
thinking about the Earth system from a natural science perspective. They also tolerate folks like myself, social scientists, who want to bring in the human dimension. So the combination of the Earth sciences and then the FSI appointment and the Center on Food Security is a great way to sort of bring social and natural science together.
But why economics? Like that? So you had a discovery or an insight somewhere along the road that if you wanted to make a more healthy planet, that you wanted to fight for that, you need to study economics. Why was that? And has that proven out to be a good bet?
Well, we'll see if I get tenure at Stanford. So it's up to you, Mike.
All right.
That's a good bet. So I think economics does a lot of things that I like. It's at least the applied side of economics is very empirical. It thinks hard about data and how we
right.
learn from data. And I think a lot of the advances in how we use data empirically have come from the field of economics lately. And so it's a very nice toolbox and lens with which to think about observational data and use these data to understand how humans shape the environment and vice versa.
Got it. So let's apply some of those methods to the state of the world today, the health of the world, the health of climate change. Give us your 30,000 feet or 50,000 feet, wherever you want to start up there. Where are we at today and where is the trajectory going over the next 10, 20, 50 years?
Okay, so where we are today is we now live in a world that's about 1 degree Celsius warmer than it was in the pre-industrial era. So over the last century, it's warmed up by about 1 degree Celsius on average.
And how bad is that?
Well, so let me get back to that.
Okay, all right.
So along with this 1 degree Celsius warming, it's been associated with many different changes around the world. We've seen an increase in extreme weather events around the world
right.
that's associated with this overall warming. We've seen a small but steady increase in sea level rise. We've seen an increase in carbon dioxide concentrations, which of course is one of the main sources of this warming. So we've seen some sort of fundamental physical changes in the climate system around the world.
And in your world, there's no disagreement about that, just to be clear, right?
There's absolutely no disagreement. That's right. So there's sort of two fundamental facts. Number one, the world is warming, and we that's a measurement. That's just a fact that we can measure.
Right.
And actually, there's very little disagreement on that part at this point. The second point is sort of what's causing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a human caused trend or is it natural variability? And among scientists, there's very little dispute that it's in fact human caused, right? It's due to human release of greenhouse gases. Our We burn things. These release greenhouse gases, and that warms the planet. The fundamental physics of this have been known since the 1800s. So there's a lot of agreement in the scientific community on both those facts. The world is warming, and humans are to blame.
And that means that changing the behavior of humans has to be part of the solution, right?
That's exactly right. So if we want to change the trajectory of future warming, then human decision-making is front and center in making that change. So current estimates would suggest if we stay on our current trajectory, a sort of business-as-usual trajectory, over the next century, we could expect, say, 4 to 5 degrees Celsius of additional warming. So we've seen 1 degree of warming so far. We could expect about 4 times that over the next century.
And just give us a sense, again, in broad terms, of what that would mean. What would that world look like if we kept on the trajectory we're on now?
So there's two things to think about. One is the sort of changes in the physical climate and the sort of natural systems, what we think of as the climate system. And then the focus of my research is trying to understand, what does this mean for social systems? What does this mean
right.
for economies? What does this mean for how people interact with each other?
Yeah.
So on the natural science side, big effort by scientists around the world to try to understand, okay, if the world warms up 4 degrees, what does that mean for extreme events? What does it mean for hurricanes? What does it mean for the likelihood of wildfires? These sorts of things. And I think the broad brush conclusion is that most sort of bad climate events are likely to get worse. We
okay.
should see stronger hurricanes. We should see more extreme events. Those will accompany this overall global warming. So now my job as a social scientist is to think about, okay, so what might that mean for human society? What sort of impacts might that cause? And that's a really important question, because then it helps us answer, okay, how much should we be willing to invest today to keep this climate change from happening, right? If,
right.
if we want to mitigate climate change, what's the cost benefit there? How much should we be willing to invest today in mitigation, in slowing our burning or emission of greenhouse gases in order to keep these bad things from happening in the future?
Right.
The way we study that is typically to use history as a laboratory. So instead of starting by looking forward,
yeah.
we start by looking backwards. We collect
okay.
data on the last, say, half century, 30 years, sort of whatever we can get, on an outcome of interest. So one thing we've studied a lot is the aggregate economic effects of climate change. And the way we study that, our group, is, again, to take observed economic output from economies around the world over the last 50 years. So we actually collect this data in the system of national accounts that was set up after World War II. So
wow.
we have decent data on most every country at the annual level for the last half century.
So you're actually a historian.
Barely. I dabble. I have okay. to speak those words at FSI
okay.
so I right. belong.
Okay.
So,
all right, so you collect that? And
yeah,
then
so we have half century of data. And then what we can do is look historically and see how countries' economies have performed in years when the temperature is really warm compared to years in which the temperature is really cool, right? And so we use this climate variability in the past to try to understand how do economic outcomes, how do social outcomes respond to changes in temperature, right? And what we see when we do that is something that's actually pretty surprising. So around the world, we see very strong economic responses to changes in temperature.
Huh.
And our research design allows us to say something pretty precise about the causal impact of these climate factors, right?
Okay.
So we think of year-to-year variation in temperature as sort of random historically, right?
Right.
Whether it's a hot year or a cool year, at least historically, has been sort of random.
Most
and
certainly the economy itself is not. Well, no, go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you.
No. It can be a tricky empirical problem. But the idea is if it's hotter this year than it was last year, and part of that is plausibly random, we can use that randomness to identify the effects on some economic outcome. So we can't run a randomized control trial here, but
right.
we're trying to basically emulate a randomized control trial.
And what are the results?
Right. So what we find is that if you are in a cold country, place like Iceland, Russia even,
yeah.
Place near and dear to your heart, I know, warmer than average temperatures historically have led to much higher growth rates in GDP per capita, which I think makes some sense, right? If it's really, really cold out, it's hard to be productive economically,
right?
right? And so if you're in a really cold place and warm the temperature up a little bit, you see more economic output, you
right.
see growth in economic output. The opposite is true in really hot places. So go to the tropics, right? Tropics are already pretty hot in the tropics. If you warm temperatures there, we see very clearly in the data that those economies grow more slowly when it's hot out, right? So in cool places, you sort of benefit when you crank up the temperature. In hot places, you see the reverse effect. And this sort of overall effect on economic output has now also been observed for all the sort of building blocks of economies. It's been observed for agriculture. It's been observed for labor productivity. It's been observed for health outcomes. So in all of these, we see this sort of nonlinear response where if it's cold and you warm it up a little bit, you often benefit. If it's hot to start with and you warm it up even more, you're often harmed. So this history as laboratory then gives us a good sense of how these economic outcomes respond to changes in temperature. So then what we do is we run the world forward. Climate scientists tell us, okay, the world's going to warm by 4 degrees Celsius. We can use this historical understanding to then say, okay, if we crank up the temperature 4 degrees Celsius, what's going to happen? What would be our sort of best guess of what happens to the economy?
So you're modeling what might happen in the future.
We're modeling, yeah. So the historical part is it's sort of an empirical model, and then we take that empirical model real seriously and sort of run the world forward and try to estimate what happens.
And give us the punchline, 50 years out or...
So the punchline, and it's sort of an insane exercise on one level, right? We're making projections out 50 years or out 100 years, and all sorts of stuff is going to change over the next century that we cannot anticipate, right?
Right.
So big caveat there. But fundamentally, we have to make a decision about important policies today, and these policies and these decisions depend fundamentally on having estimates out 50 years, out 100 years. We need to have some guess of what's going to happen.
Where we're going, right.
Where we're going, exactly. So to us, this is sort of the most informed way to make that guess. So our then best guess is that the thought experiment here is to compare two worlds. Compare a world today where we fix temperatures and we don't allow any warming over the next century, right? We just stay at our current temperature. Compare that to a world where the climate change sort of business as usual world where we warm up by 4 degrees, okay? So a no climate change world and a climate change world. We find that the difference between those two worlds is about 20% of GDP. That is to say, if we warm the world by 4 degrees, we are going to lose 20% of global GDP compared to what would have happened had we not warmed the world. And that is an enormous number, up in the hundreds of trillions of dollars. So you can think of that as the big pile of money that we're throwing away if we warm the world by 4 degrees. So the critical policy question is, so that's going to be the impact of climate change. Think of this as the global economic impact of climate change.
Right.
The policymaker...
Although you hinted that it doesn't impact everybody the same way.
That's exactly right.
You know, I've lived in Russia many times. I was an ambassador there once for a couple of years. And I remember when we discussed this with our Russian colleagues, they saw upside to climate change. Tell me why they're wrong about that.
Actually, I'm not sure that they
You're
are
not
wrong
sure.
about that.
Because there are winners and losers, right?
There are winners and losers, and that's what these data would suggest. So if you're in a cold region, at least within your country, now the trading system could change this fundamentally, but at least within your country, if you warm it up a little bit, you're likely to be more productive within your country.
Right.
And Russia is actually a great example. You can see this incredibly clearly in the Russian data.
Is that right?
Yeah, you can. The Russian economy grows much faster in warmer than average years, just since 1990, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, where we have good data. It's remarkable. Same thing in Iceland, same thing in a bunch of the Northern European countries. It shows up really clearly.
But the aggregate's 20% negative.
The aggregate is 20% negative, right? And so if you're in Russia, it's going to be this trade-off between sort of benefits in your own country and then potential harm to many of your trading partners on whom you depend, right? And so the trade-off there, I think, is a little bit complicated.
So let's pivot a little now to prescriptions. And I think about it, there's the governmental things, there's industry, and then there's individuals. Let's start with the government. I was part of the Obama administration and lead up to the Paris Climate Agreement. I was actually in Copenhagen, not to talk about climate change, to talk about arms control, but I traveled there with the president, and that wasn't such a great trip. But then there was this, for us, this fantastic achievement, at least I remember it that way, and most certainly the president did. President Trump decided to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Tell us first just the basics of what that agreement is and what are the negative repercussions or positive repercussions of the United States pulling out.
Yeah, great. So the global community has for almost two decades now tried to come together and coordinate on climate policy, to try to do something. So this climate problem has been recognized for a long time. Again, we're learning a lot more about the specific details, but The basic facts about climate change and how much climate might change have been more or less known for a while, right? So the global community has been grappling with this problem for a while. Early on, we tried very sort of punitive ways of getting countries to sign up to these agreements. You would sign up, you would commit to very binding targets, and if you didn't commit, sort of bad things would happen. Often countries didn't want to sign up to binding targets. They felt this was, for various reasons, either not in their own sort of self-interest. And so the approach that was taken at Paris, the most recent climate agreement signed in 2015, was fundamentally different. Instead of signing up for binding targets, each country got to choose what their own, what was called NDCs, nationally determined contribution, basically what they were going
to
do
willing
for the climate
pledge,
problem.
Right?
Yeah, what their willingness was, right? So each country makes its own pledge. And the idea was that if everyone makes a pledge, number one, everything is out in the open. And number two, we can use shame, just the sort of the global system and the shame induced by making a pledge and then not following through with it to try to get people to follow through on their pledges.
Okay.
And over time, we would sort of ratchet up these pledges and get people to take, stronger and stronger stances. Right?
Okay.
So that was the basic agreement. It's fundamentally different than the earlier climate agreements.
Right.
And I think there was a lot of excitement around it because it brought every big emitter to the table. Pretty much everyone signed on.
Right.
Everyone made commitments.
And China and the U.S. were the key ones, right?
China and the U.S. were the key ones. They played a big role in making sure the agreement happened. So I think in 2015, there was a lot of excitement, and this was viewed, I think, overall as a victory for sort of climate mitigation efforts. Okay, so Trump decides to pull out. What does this mean? I think we don't fully know the consequences yet, but let me give you sort of three stories. One is maybe a glass half full, one is a glass half empty, and one is a completely empty glass, right?
Okay.
So the empty glass first, the most pessimistic story is that this is going to be a disaster, right? Trump pulls out, we lose all American credibility and leadership on this topic. Countries that otherwise would have kept their pledges are now no longer going to keep their pledges because they see no reason to. If the U.S., one of the world's largest emitters, is not going to keep their pledge, why should they?
Right.
And so the whole deal sort of collapses. We'll see if that happens. Too early to tell. That's the most pessimistic view. The glass half empty view, so slightly less pessimistic view, is that what countries signed up for was what they were going to do anyway, right?
Okay,
what they brought to the table were pledges that they could sort of keep, and that was sort of that they were on track to hit anyway.
Okay.
And so these are pledges by 2030. So this is what countries are supposed to do over the next, decade and a half, right? And so the idea there would be, okay, the U.S. pulls out, but maybe that doesn't really matter. Countries had just sort of said what they were going to do anyway, and so the U.S. pulling out might not have a fundamental effect.
And Trump's policies so far have not affected those projections?
So, and this is where I think it gets tricky. So, so we make these international commitments at the Paris Agreement, but those are tied to domestic policies that should help us meet these commitments.
Right.
And the most dangerous thing here, to me, is that the administration has now tried to undo the domestic policies that would help us
that
meet
supported
these targets,
right?
So the Clean Power Plan passed in the Obama administration was the sort of flagship domestic effort to reduce our dependence on dirtier sources of energy, on coal in particular.
Uh-huh.
Trump is much more friendly to coal country and has tried to reverse the sort of main elements of the Clean Power Plan.
Right.
So that to me is quite concerning and likely means that the U.S., unless those policies, his policies are then reversed, the U.S. is unlikely to meet its commitments, right? So
okay.
The pessimistic view is then that sort of precipitates this domino effect where no one wants to meet their commitments, right? Okay. Here's the optimistic view.
Good.
The optimistic
we need an
view,
optimistic view, yes.
Some optimism, as much as I can muster here. The optimistic view is that a lot of the changes that we've seen in terms of emissions, and we've actually seen remarkable decline in the amount of emissions per unit of GDP, right? So you could think of, where we make something as an economy, and in making that thing, we emit some amount of CO2. The amount of CO2 we emit per unit of economic output has actually declined over time or flattened.
Because?
because of a number of things, because of many different market forces. Mm-hmm. Well, policy has been important too, but a large part is just market forces making other sources of cleaner energy more affordable. So the movement from coal to natural gas. So fracking has made natural gas much cheaper in the U.S.
Of course,
natural gas is a less potent greenhouse gas emitter than coal. And in renewables, prices have come down dramatically. So prices for solar now are cost competitive with coal in many parts of the world, right? So fundamental and incredible market changes.
And a really rapid change, right?
Incredibly rapid change.
Right.
I mean, this is literally just the last few years.
Right.
That have fundamentally changed the energy landscape and have dramatically reduced emissions per unit economic output. So if you actually look at emissions in the U.S. For the last 3 or 4 years in a period of pretty strong economic growth, they've been almost flat.
Which is
progress,
great. Yeah.
Right. And so the optimistic view would be sort of no matter what happens on the policy side, we have these market fundamentals that are just pushing us in this sort of cleaner direction. The question are those going to happen fast enough? Are they going to push us far enough, particularly in the absence of policy, to get to where we want to be on the climate change side? And I think it's hard to make a case that it's going to happen as quickly as we need it to avoid some of these really negative impacts that we're worried about.
Without the kind of incentives that would come from government policy,
precisely.
Right?
Precisely.
Well, half full, but a little bit full.
Yeah.
But
maybe.
But that maybe gets me to the last question I wanted to ask you about, which is, so industry, obviously, market forces, as you just described, are moving us in a positive direction, irrespective of any kind of normative commitment to the planet. Is that right?
That's right.
Does the normative piece play any role, either at the company level or at the individual level? Or in the aggregate data that you study over decades, is that just kind of wash out? So when I go to throw away my Coke can and I put it here versus there, something I didn't do as a kid, but I do now. I think I'm making a normative move there. I don't think that's a law that I have to do that, is it? Now that I think about it?
I don't think so.
Is it? Okay. Does any of that matter? In other words, can individuals do anything to help with the climate change problem?
I think absolutely. We can think of a range of actions individuals can take, all the way from the very small, you know, turning off your lights at night, you know, the energy conservation stuff that a lot of us
uh-huh.
think to do and don't always do, but would like to do, and we're
right.
being good people. All the way, individual actions, all the way to individuals' ability to influence policy. So again,
right.
we think market forces are going to take us some of the way to where we want to be, but they're not going to take us nearly far enough, right? We need policy. We need policy incentives to help the market make the sort of correct decision on this, right? And the only way that's going to happen, or one way it's going to happen, is to have a lot of people who are vocal about seeing certain policy outcomes sort of privileged over other policy outcomes, right? Policy outcomes we're seeing right now from the Trump administration are not ones that push us in that direction, right? And so the more normative point would be, you know, people who are interested in this issue should get involved and help push for policies that lead to better outcomes.
So learn more by reading anything that Marshall Burke writes and go to their website at the Center for Food Security and the Environment. And once you've learned more, then take action. I think that's a message I'm going to take away, and I'm going to do that
great.
Myself. So thank
great.
You, Marshall, for being here.
Thanks, Mike.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Follow us on Twitter at FSI Stanford or visit our website at fsi.stanford.edu for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.